Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the LawCast. Today we're going to be taking a trip back in time to 1990, but first I want to kind of touch on something we don't normally do on this show, which is current wrestling events. Because in light of the TNA show we did last week, I feel like we might want to cover the current situation with Global Force Wrestling. Sounds like we're respelling Jeff Jarrett's name, GONNEE, gone.
Yeah, I really don't know what to make of it. He just came back. Now there's all these rumors that Anthem is going to sell to WWE again, and they're going to get the video library. And I honestly don't even know what to make of it. Like, it seems like every 3 months we get this exact rumor all
It's
over again.
been 3 years of this now. It was like the fall of 2014, they announced that the Spike deal was done. And ever since then, it's just been this permanent state of like, they're on their deathbed. It's almost over. They're about to sell out. And somehow TNA always kicks out at two, but maybe this is finally the end.
I just can't wait. At this point, I don't really know what future there could possibly be for TNA. I think this was sort of like the last gasp chance. And if this isn't going to happen, then it's not going to happen. But I do. Heck, what? I'm just waiting for Bruce Pritchard to buy it and just rename it something to wrestle with Bobby Lashley.
And the irony being, it seemed like they're moving in the right direction.
It had been a
Right?
lot
Do I have
better. They got a
that
lot
right? Yeah.
more like name stars. They got a lot more interesting things going on. They brought in a lot of new people. It seemed a lot more fresh. But at the end of the day, can you ever really scrub that stink off?
No, I mean they did rebrand apparently to a brand name that they don't own because they didn't buy the rights to Global Force Wrestling from Jarrett. So maybe next week they're just back to being Impact.
They rebranded to a brand they don't own, ladies and gentlemen, TNA.
Oh, so we probably won't keep an eye on that as it develops. I just wanted to bring that up because we had done the Genesis of TNA episode last week.
Oh guys, my fellow TNA faithful out there, keep heart. Our long nightmare may soon be over.
So we go from one company in crisis to another company in crisis, and that's WCW circa late 1990. Now, a couple months ago, we did the Great American Bash 1989, and it was a triumph, the best, maybe the best WCW pay-per-view ever, certainly the best of the era. And here we are a year later, and it feels like a totally different company, and all of the good things that were happening in 1980 and 89 feel long gone by this point.
It's amazing how it doesn't even feel like the same company anymore. It really doesn't. Like, all of the talent, like almost all of it, completely gone. The production is completely changed and modernized. They've like changed the announce crews a little bit. There's a lot more like Missy Hyatt than there was. It feels like a totally different show. And we're not talking about like a year and a half, almost 2 years. Like, it's like a year. And
Yeah.
it's wildly different.
Jim Herd was brought in to run WCW after Turner bought it. And he was brought in with the mandate to cut costs. And he was cutting those costs by getting rid of as much of their name talent as he possibly could. I mean, if you looked back at Bash 89, the big matches were Flair versus Funk, Sting versus Muda, Steamboat versus Luger. And the War Games match that had the Legion of Doom and the Midnight Express against the Freebirds and the Samoan SWAT team. You look at this show, Funk is gone, Steamboat's gone, Muda's gone, Road Warriors are gone, and the Midnight Express, Stan Lane is either gone or about to be gone, and Cornette will be gone too before much longer. Just all of them run off due to either creative disputes or, pay disputes with Herd.
Now, I must say, like, I had always kind of understood the narrative from this time to being like both A, they didn't have any like good direction, but also B, in trying to make it World Championship Wrestling, because after Ted Turner bought it, they lost a lot of their like regional appeal and they lost the Southern fans and tried to make it more national, which alienated a lot of their audience. That's the narrative that I understood. That's not the show we got here. I know it's still the NWA, I guess, now, but they're clearly trying to go national. This is the southernest fucking show I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, Bischoff was the guy who tried to get rid of the southernness of the company. There was maybe some move towards that. I think when people... What people are talking about when they talk about that is probably moving Starrcade out of the South, which was in 87. They tried to run Starrcade up in Chicago after it had always been Greensboro and Atlanta before that. But yeah, when you watch this, this is still 100% Southern wrestling. I mean, Ole Anderson had been brought in as the booker, and he's basically booking this like it's Georgia 1984.
Yeah. Yeah, he is.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you really want to get into all the behind-the-scenes machinations, I would strongly recommend the Jim Cornette Kayfabe Commentary 1990 shoot interview. It's incredible. He's actually got his old notes from the booking meetings in 1990, so they can go into incredible detail on, like, what the plans were, what happened in the meeting, how things changed. If you've got, you know, 3 hours to burn, I would recommend checking that out. But just kind of briefly, like I said, Ole Anderson has replaced George Scott as the head of the booking committee. The rest of it's hazy to me. I think Flair had quit the committee by this point because he was fed up with Hurd. Jim Cornette is on the verge of quitting. Jim Ross, Kevin Sullivan, those guys are still there. But everyone, I think, is really starting to get tired of Jim Hurd's shit by this point. One of Jim Hurd's big things was he wanted new guys. He was sick of, you know, Ric Flair and Sting and Lex Luger, so kept telling Ole Anderson, we need some new guys on this show. So to placate Hurd, Ole Anderson came up with a new guy in the form of the Black Scorpion, a mysterious, sinister figure from Sting's past coming to get revenge on him. I don't think this is a bad idea in theory. I think the execution of the storyline is abysmal.
This storyline has been done better before, and it's an awesome way to get people like super, super interested in what you have behind the mask. The problem is that it's almost always disappointing because you almost always, you can't really just come up with the, like, okay, let me just lay all the cards on the table. When this inevitably wasn't going to be the Ultimate Warrior, everyone was going to be disappointed, right?
They are so planning for this to be the Warrior, which is absurd because the Warrior was the WWF champion at this point.
And
I don't know how they thought they were going to get him.
I mean, if they had done the storyline like a year or two later, they could have had him, and it could have been the Warrior. But like to do it now.
2 years after that, 1 year after this, they bring in Rick Rude as the Halloween Phantom, and it's one of the few like really good mystery reveals in wrestling history where they build up who was the Halloween Phantom for a couple months. And then at Halloween Havoc, it's revealed it's Rick Rude. And like Rick Rude wouldn't really fit as the Black Scorpion. But if it'd been like Rick Rude or Jake Roberts actually would have fit perfectly. But if it had actually been a star of that caliber, then I think it would have been cool. Everybody would have just kind of forgotten the weirdness of like, why was Rick Rude wearing a, you know, black cloak and talking like Darth Vader?
Well, they kind of did it all wrong. Instead of making it just like this guy in black wants Sting, you don't know why, he won't explain why, but he wants Sting and he wants the belt. All right, that's fine. But they kind of like, they handcuffed it to the line, it's someone from Sting's past. At this point, Sting's only been in the industry for like 3 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
he's only wrestled like 30 people.
The only guy from his past is the Ultimate Warrior. And like, I doubt that many people remembered the Blade Runners because they, you know, didn't really get national exposure. But immediately anybody in the know is going to pick up on, oh, it's supposed to be the Warrior. Which, you know, is, and they started this, they wrote this mystery without knowing what the reveal was going to be. And that, it feels like that should be a basic rule of wrestling or any kind of creative form. If you've got a big twist, if you're doing a murder mystery, you got to know who the killer is before you start it. But it seems like very frequently in wrestling, they start these big mystery storylines without knowing what the reveal is going to be.
And I mean, it's possible to talk about the Black Scorpion without bringing up like the Vince McMahon higher power thing.
Yep.
Because that's like its closest allegory in WWE.
But like they have the same wardrobe.
Yes. The one credit to WWE, though, is that when that was supposed to originally be Christopher Daniels before they decided not to have it be Christopher Daniels, because I guess Vince saw how small he was.
Too short.
Yeah. But once they decided, like, oh, shit, we're not going to be able to pay this off, they just went outrageous with it, but they rolled with it and, like, made something completely new from that. You have to at least roll with it. Here they were just like, eh, it's Ric Flair.
Yeah, Flair took one for the team for that. Right. Like, it was him or Barry Windham, and his feeling was, like, this could hurt Barry, whereas Flair was untouchable by 90, you know?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Just, and the other crazy thing about it, and we're skipping ahead to the end here, but Flair is the Black Scorpion, loses the title match to Sting at Starrcade 90, and then Flair wins the belt, like, a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
Like, so his master plan fails, but then he ends up getting the belt anyway.
I just love that if you understand this the entire way, as the Black Scorpion is Ric Flair, then it's important to note that Ric Flair wrestles two title matches on this show. He's attempting to become U.S. champion so he can get a world title shot on a show where he already has a world title shot, but he sends a mercenary to do it instead of himself when he could have just won the belt and ripped off the mask and been Ric Flair. See, this is why you can't try to apply logic to these things.
No. And the other part of the problem is, other than the Black Scorpion, this is a pretty grounded, like, they're still doing a lot of, like, this is the NWA, this is serious wrestling
right.
stuff. But they've also given, like, this Druid a shot at the world title, even though he's never wrestled a match before.
Yeah, and we'll kind of get to the top 10 list later on, and we'll kind of discuss that. But to, like, have, like, a pure sports-based, like, these people have won these matches, and that's why they're here, and, oh my God, who's the mystery man? Give him a title shot.
Yeah. So, anyway, for the show, it's September 5th, 1990, Clash of the Champions 12, Fall Brawl / Mountain Madness. They kind of went back and forth on what the actual title was. It's from the Asheville Civic Center in Asheville, North Carolina, about 4,000 people in attendance. And this actually drew a great rating. It did a 5.0, which was the highest rated clash. I think it might have actually done better than the Sting Flair clash, the first one.
I think it just goes to show, like, people were interested in the mystery.
Yeah.
I mean,
just like people were interested in what Kurt Angle's mystery was, until it turned out that it was that Jason Jordan was his son.
Yep, that's the first Raw I tuned into live, I think, this entire year. And
it was so much better if it was Dixie Carter.
Oh my God, it would have been so great. Here's my son, Dixie Carter!
So, Jim Ross and Bob Caudle are on commentary. Tony Schiavone and Missy Hyatt on the interviews. Thought the commentary was just fine. Jim Ross is always great. Bob Caudle was fine. It was a good team for the tone of the product they were going for at this point.
I did want to make a point of, like, pointing this out, because, like, Jim Ross is doing, like, the Mae Young Classic now, and it's sort of nice to see him, and it's, like, nostalgic and everything, but when you see him here in his element, it really drives home how much he sucks now. And I'm not trying to hold that against JR, but you can't be a play-by-play announcer who's so divorced from the industry and from the product. Because what made JR so good is that he was so in the moment with the product while also seamlessly shilling all the stuff that he has to shill, you know?
When they announced him as the play-by-play guy for the Mae Young Classic, I was like, that's not correct. That is not the right person to be doing this.
No. Michael Cole.
Morrow or Michael Cole. Like,
Cole did such a phenomenal job with the UK tournament, and that was with a product he didn't know shit about. Why not?
Yeah. So our opening match is the Freebirds against the Southern Boys. The Freebirds, you know, come out rocking to Bad Street USA, which there is not a single other good piece of entrance music on this show. It's incredible that song exists and WCW produced it.
It's so good. And there's also, like, there's little clips that they're showing of all the big stars, like, before they come out. It's almost like entrance videos, but it, like, takes up the whole screen. It's like they're just showing you the entrance video. It's actually kind of neat. I like it. And for this one, literally they show like the music video for Bad Street USA, which is super cool and badass.
Yeah, like black and white, Michael Hayes with his long hair and they're strut down the block and looking so tough.
It is so cool right up until the moment where Michael Hayes starts to sing. And then it's like, oh, oh, right. You can't sing at all.
So the Freebirds come out rocking their Confederate flag gear. And I go, oh, man. Well, at least they're the bad guys. You know, it's a different time. And then the Southern Boys come out. They've got Confederate flag gear on, too.
I was so confused about that. Like, you can't both be pro-Confederacy. Like, who's the baby faces? I don't get it.
It's the South. Yeah, you can be.
I mean,
it's Southern wrestling. Like, yeah, you're gonna have Confederate flags. It's just how it goes.
I mean, look, I'm a Yankee through and through. I grew up in Southern Virginia, but even with that being the case, like, I'm a Yankee through and through. So Southern wrestling and the entire like archetype and meaning behind this in this era, like, I'm never going to get it. I'm never going to support it. I'm never going to really feel that way. But it was just, it was so bizarre. Not only do the Freebirds have Confederate flags on, they have Confederate flag face paint. Like, they're the road warriors for the Confederacy.
That's actually a great idea now that I think of it. I'm surprised they didn't go with that gimmick.
It's just fascinating. Like, that's all the gimmick is here. It's exactly the same as in WWE when they do gimmicks like the Patriot or like the Super American people. It's exactly that same thing for the South.
Yeah. So the Southern Boys are a replacement level Southern tag team of Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong, who's a member of the Armstrong wrestling family, brother of the Road Dog. They're kind of just, it's two guys I felt didn't really stand out. Freebirds are Hayes and Garvin here, and Buddy Roberts is on the floor with his arm in a sling. Bullet Bob Armstrong is in the corner of the Southern Boys. He's way more over than the Southern Boys are. And it's just a typical Southern-style tag match where the Southern Boys get shined up, the Freebirds take over, and then we get a hot tag, some chaos. Bullet Bob steps in, throws a fist, and Southern Boys get the win. Pretty good match to open the show. One of the better matches on the card.
Yeah, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, the Freebirds are really good at what they do. Why wasn't Terry Gordy with them in WCW at this point?
I think he was making too much money in Japan to come over and work. Gordy later comes in, and he and Steve Williams form a really badass tag team.
Nice.
And they have some awesome matches with the Steiner brothers. We'll have to do, can't think of what show that was. I think it was Great American Bash 93 where they have the tag team tournament. But yeah, Bill Watts later gets Gordy in. But I think it's another kind of Dr. Death case where he was making so much money in Japan that WCW couldn't afford him.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Second match, Buddy Landell versus Captain Mike Rotunda.
Oh my God.
So first, why is Buddy Landell allowed to do the Nature Boy gimmick when Flair is there?
You know, I saw you put that in the notes, and like the only thing I could think when I saw that question is it kind of like, all right, it's Buddy Landell. You know he's not the real Nature Boy. It's like if you had like a version of The Rock on the roster at the same time as The Rock, but it's like Juventud Guerrera's version, and you're like, all right, this is the joke version.
Yeah. Well, they don't treat him like a joke. And this match, I guess it's supposed to get Rotunda over, but God, Mike Rotunda is a baby face. Like, he's just one of those guys who should only be a heel. Like, he's just a heel. Like, he has no energy and enthusiasm in the ring. He works a heel style. He looks like a heel. And what the fuck is he the captain of?
A ship? A team? It changes.
Yeah, he's a sailor, I guess.
A couple things about this. Mike Rotunda, and you know, as IRS, he kind of found his personality a little bit and had some fun moments. But Mike Rotunda spent his whole career never changing his facial expression, and I don't understand how he had the career that he had, honestly. Like, he was a perfectly fine wrestler who just had the just negative 1,000 personality.
Yeah.
And I'll never understand it.
worked okay for IRS because he was playing. Well, they kind of treated him like an accountant, but yeah, obviously a tax enforcer.
He was what WWE thought Lance Storm actually was. And for some reason, he had a much better career. I'll never understand that. The other thing is, like walking him down to the ring here, I guess this is like a 16-year-old girl who won something called like the Burger King Slam contest or something like that.
She wrote the best poem.
She wrote a poem about Mike Rotunda. I tried valiantly to find this poem so I could read it to you guys on the air. There is no copy of it anywhere that I was able to find.
Probably.
And they literally
for the best,
give,
but that was not
think about how but think about how WWE like gives attention to anybody who wins a contest or any like charity person they have in the audience. This poor girl walks 10 steps with Mike Rotunda in her best prom
and
dress.
He's like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, and just like shoves her to the side.
Again, he's a heel. I thought the most interesting part of this match was Jim Ross and Bob Caudle trying to explain what Skid Row is.
Yes. Buddy Landell gets right up to the camera, points to a Skid Row tattoo, and says, Skid Row, baby! Best band in the world! Which
hey, one of those rock and roll bands. You know them.
And this is the South, right? Skid Row is not a Southern rock band. Who the fuck loves Skid Row that much?
This match has more questions than answers. It's a boring match. Neither of these guys, they're both like just kind of competent, solid technicians, but no energy, no charisma. Rotunda wins with a backslide in 5 minutes. Who cares?
It's literally the only match I think I've ever seen in a backslide.
Yeah. More fun is the next match, which was a complete train wreck.
Oh, so fun.
White Lightning, Tim Horner, and Brad Armstrong against the Master Blasters. The Master Blasters are Kevin Nash and some dude. Couldn't figure out who this dude was. The guy was so bad in this match that I'm pretty sure they fired him after this.
Yeah.
And replaced him with Al Green.
Now, Al Green was the guy who had sort of trained Kevin Nash a little bit and who had been his tag team partner on the indies. And so they realize in this match that Kevin Nash is way too green to be on his own with somebody else who's not a vet.
Yeah, he was better. This other guy was literally like the worst wrestler I've ever seen.
He did like diving headbutts that literally landed 5 feet away.
Oh my God. And like the commentators are, didn't quite get all of that one.
And intimidation tactic.
The crowd's booing him, but like they're not. It's not heat. It's just like, boo, this sucks.
Yeah, they don't boo Kevin Nash for 1 second, but they boo the shit out of the other guy every time he does anything. And it must be said, Kevin Nash looks like $1 billion here.
Oh, my God. He's so big.
He's
huge.
This
is probably when he was – like, this is what – he was probably on the gas here, and he wasn't later in his career, but holy shit, did he look amazing.
Yeah, he's big, but he's trim. And he's moving around real good. He's awkward as fuck. Like, he's dropping elbows that, like, he's literally, he goes for the elbow drop, and it looks like in his eyes, he's not sure how to fall down. Like, it's one of those.
How did WCW let this guy go?
I know. Like, literally, he will do nothing between the Master Blasters and Oz.
Yeah, I mean, they just, Oz, Vinny Vegas, this just parade of shit gimmicks, and they never give him a real push.
And then, like, the second Vince gets a hold of him, he's just like, this is easy.
World champion.
Here we go.
Yeah. So the Master Blasters win. It's pretty much an enhancement match. They're total Road Warrior knockoffs. Like, the original Mad Max-inspired Road Warriors. Like, less on the face paint and the spikes, more just kind of post-apocalyptic leather. But, like, just these guys should not have been on national TV. Like, these guys should have been in school.
Absolutely. And just imagine what could have been if they had actually like had Kevin Nash come along slowly and then put him in when he was ready. And like, holy shit, the whole history of the WCW would be different. Like, it's crazy. I also want to give a shout out to White Lightning, Tim Horner, and Candyman Brad Armstrong.
I forgot what gimmick he had at this point. The Candyman.
WCW
took kids away from them.
Had the worst fucking nicknames I've ever heard in my entire life.
I think that's a Jim Herd thing. He was just like, yeah, it's for kids. The Candyman.
The Candyman.
He'll throw candy to him. It'll be like a parade.
Also, is the Armstrong wrestling family the most disappointing wrestling family of all time?
I mean, Road Dogg had a nice run and is now one of the most powerful men in professional wrestling.
But I mean, it's like four brothers and three of them were just shitty jobbers.
Yeah. Yeah. Next match, the Nasty Boys against Jackie Fulton and Terry Taylor. This is a lot of tag matches.
Really lame
tag matches on heavy here. This is another job match. The Nasty Boys are the new hot heels, so Taylor and Fulton are just here to do the jobs. Terry Taylor has just come back from being the Red Rooster in the WWF, and turns out that gimmick kneecapped him forever, which is probably all the best because he seems like a complete dick in real life, too.
Yep. Talentless dick. Literally, the only thing that made me even look at Terry Taylor this whole time was I started looking at his robe, and like something about it was bothering me, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I'm like 95% sure that that's the robe that Bobby Roode wore when he first became like Robert Roode. So I think Terry Taylor actually gave him his robe. I would need to check on that, but I'm like, God damn, that robe looks familiar.
He pulled it out of the crawl space in the basement.
There you go.
This wasn't a bad match. It's just kind of a basic tag match. The Nasties win with a power slam and a flying elbow. The elbow was pretty impressive. Do not remember the Nasty Boys coming off the top rope much, but they were young and fairly trim here.
I always thought Jerry Sags was kind of okay. Like, I don't hate the Nasty Boys. Brian Knobbs does not have any wrestling talent, but like as a team, it kind of worked when they were younger and could still move.
They have a cool look. It's a cool gimmick. Like, I get why. I mean, they were definitely pushed harder than they should have been. It's because they were friends of Hogan. But
friends of Hogan.
Best thing you can be. But, yeah. I mean, nothing here. You know, just
right.
This is like three matches in a row that have just been strikeouts. And that's not about to change.
It seemed like Jim Herd's entire concept was go find a bunch of bland white dudes from the South and just put them on TV and maybe one of them will get over.
Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, this is a Clash of the Champions. This is supposed to be a big special and it's all job matches.
Yeah. And not good ones. Like the people going over aren't even stars.
Yeah. So next we get an interview with a very young and good looking Tony Schiavone interviewing Sid Vicious, who says he wants this shot at Sting, says he deserves the shot more than the Black Scorpion. And hey, he's actually right, because the Black Scorpion's never wrestled a match before.
Though, I gotta say, Sid Vicious looked amazing on this show.
This was a great promo, too. Sid's promos. I mean, I think I've been one of the people over the years who have shit on his promos, and like, he had some embarrassing screw-ups. But he just radiated intensity. Like, really believed he was going to kill somebody.
Later in his career, he would kind of try to get all cerebral with his promos, and that's where it all went to shit. And those are the jokey promos you always remember. But, like, early in his career, and, like, in WWE even, like, he would, like, just, like, for 10 seconds talk, and he'd be like, oh, my God.
Just seems like a madman.
Yeah.
Next, we've got Bill Irwin against Tommy Rich. Holy shit, Tommy Rich in 1990.
Why?
Oh, God. He's only 35 here because he was really, really young when they gave him that four-day world title reign in the early 80s. But
let's say, kids, early in the 80s, Tommy Rich was in a feud with Buzz Sawyer. And it was one of the most renowned feuds of the 20th century. It was a big deal, big box office, huge. They wrestled each other like 100 times, bloody, bloody brawls. Like, it was the best of Southern wrestling. It really was. Tommy Rich's career did not exist before that, and it did not exist after that. You do not need to know his name outside of it.
Come on, he had a 4-day world title reign.
I don't know what caused Harley Race to agree to drop in the belt to Tommy Rich, but yeah. I'm sure he got paid.
Yeah, well, Harley had gotten his revenge because a couple months before this at the Great American Bash, he had beaten Rich in 3 minutes.
And we're talking about like 100-year-old Harley Race.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even realize he was still wrestling in 1990. I thought he retired after he messed up his neck against Hogan on the Saturday night's main event, but apparently he had a quick little run here back in WCW.
Got to get my receipt, brother.
So Rich wins here in 3 minutes with the Thez Press. It's another of those, like, what are they going for here? Like, Tommy Rich has been doing jobs. Why is he getting a squash match on the Clash of the Champions?
Literally, the announcers don't have anything positive to say about either one of these guys. And that really struck me while I was watching the match. Is like, JR just like, yeah, so here's Tommy Rich. He won the title a long time ago. And here's Bill Irwin. He lost about 30 pounds. Good for him.
He needed it.
Yeah. Well, he's a big tub of shit when we saw him at the Great American Bash.
Oh, that match was way better. That match had that awesome splash by Pillman.
Yes.
Hey, Brian Pillman, that's another guy they've screwed over by this point.
And actually, he's on this show, too. And they're doing this thing called...
Oh, yeah, the Gauntlet.
The Gauntlet. Now, here's the idea of the Gauntlet, okay? WCW has 3 television shows at this point. Depending on where you live in the country, you probably can't watch all 3 of these shows.
No, but, probably not.
But there are 3 of them. And so he's attempting to become the first person to win a match on all 3 shows in the same week. And if he can do it, he gets $15,000.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah.
$15,000, that's a lot of money down there.
Shit, that's probably his whole yearly paycheck during the Jim Herd era.
That's not as good as the $5,000 ladder match. Wrestling. I wish they'd knocked a zero off and it had been $500.
Yes, but if he can't do it, all 3 of his opponents get $5,000. Which seems great for his opponents, and he doesn't know who they're going to be. And so, like, the whole time they're talking about this, and, like, it literally takes 15 minutes for Tony Schiavone to explain this.
Oh, my God.
Brian Pillman is in the back looking, like, visibly uncomfortable. Like, they just told him he was doing this.
Yeah. If I'm remembering this right, this was designed to put over Scott Steiner. I think he ends up being he ends up being the only guy to manage to run the gauntlet successfully. Because if Jim Herd was right about one thing, it was that Scott Steiner should have been a big single star.
It only took another 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. A great mystery of kind of why he never got his push until 1999. But, so next, they do the top 10 rankings. They rank the top 10 heavyweight world title contenders and the top 10 tag team contenders. I like that they do this. The problem is this is the worst show you could possibly debut this on because an unranked contender is getting a shot at the world title on this show.
And they don't make it clear that they are debuting it on this show. They're just like, oh, yeah, here's the top 10. They're not just like, hey, we've devised this top 10 list to help pick out title contenders. Other companies have tried to do this in the past. Ring of Honor tried to do it. TNA tried to do it. Like, it's a thing that people have tried to do. And it always sounds great because you can just kind of communicate to your audience, here's who to take seriously. Here's who the upcoming people are. Number 5 can feud with number 7, and it makes sense because he wants to move up. Yeah. The problem is it handcuffs you to that list.
Yeah. You have to really you have to plan things out for months if you're going to make this work.
Exactly. If you don't book to the list, it's a worthless piece of shit and you're wasting everyone's time. And just on this show, where they introduce it, like the tag teams that are on the top 10, none of them are on this show.
No. When TNA brought this in, didn't Nigel McGuinness win the fan vote even though like he wasn't even wrestling anymore?
Yeah, that was a little ways into it. And so they decided to do like include fan voting in with it to sort of help. And literally Nigel McGuinness was the number one contender for like 3 months in a row. And they just never acknowledged it.
Yeah. Oh boy. Tony Schiavone interviews Stan Hansen. And this is awesome because he has chewing tobacco dripping out of his mouth.
I
Is this more Southern than the Dueling Confederate Flags match?
I guess. I couldn't. Look, I am a gigantic Stan Hansen fan. If you've ever read my blog, it's probably pretty clear that I'm a gigantic Stan Hansen fan. But I'm a gigantic All Japan Stan Hansen fan. I'm a gigantic The Giant Lariat Cowboy from America who beats up people in the crowd fan. The guy who's drooling tobacco juice on himself and is squinting at the camera because he can't read his lines is not who I'm a fan of. Why did they saddle him with this?
He has very poor eyesight. That's why the lariat was so stiff. He had to make sure he hit you.
That was the beauty of it. You never knew where he was going to hit you.
He's mad that he's not ranked number one, and he can't understand why Lex Luger is ranked ahead of him. Foreshadowing.
Yeah, exactly. But like that's a good example of booking with the top 10 list. Like,
yeah.
Stan Hansen hears about the list. It pisses him off. Why am I not number one? I'm going to beat up everyone on the list ahead of me. Great. Yeah. That makes sense.
If I were taking over a company that was like in a rut, this is the kind of thing I would do just to like try to get us back on track quickly. Because I would just be like, this can create so many things naturally, and it can bring logic to our program.
If you really wanted to make some controversy, just have the PWI top 500 be the list.
Yeah. Next match, Susan Sexton versus Bambi for the, I didn't write it down, Ladies Professional Wrestling Championship?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
one step above GLOW.
Yeah, it basically was. Susan Sexton was actually a fairly credible wrestler. She worked for the only really important woman in wrestling history pre-1980, which was Mildred Burke. And like, so she has the credibility of having rubbed off on that. She was part of the Australian wrestling scene, and WCW actually does like name this their women's championship for a little bit, which is pretty interesting.
God, WCW and their women's, like, it's just every couple of years they try to do women's wrestling. It was so strange.
Yeah,
this is now two WCW shows in a row we've done where there was just a random women's match thrown in there.
I want to say, like, Jim Ross does some really interesting commentary in the middle of this match where he basically explains why there isn't more women's wrestling in WCW. And, like, I thought that was, like, really insightful on his part and, like, totally the opposite of what he's doing in the Mae Young Classics where he's just like, these girls seem pretty good. I don't know who anybody is, but cool.
What was his explanation? I remember him saying, like, basically, you know, ladies wrestling has declined in popularity in recent years.
Yeah, he was basically just like, in the early days of wrestling, it was a really huge deal, but there aren't as many women's wrestlers out there anymore. There aren't as many women's wrestling-only promotions or companies that do it, but there are still some women out there who apply in the trade, who learn from Mildred Burke and the original women. And they used to be more powerhouse wrestlers in the beginning because it was kind of more of a sideshow thing. But now with the advent of aerobics and stuff like that, now they're more agile and stuff. Like, it was a really good explanation.
Yeah. I thought this was a pretty good match, but the crowd doesn't know who they are. It wouldn't surprise me if they'd never been booked on TV before this.
WCW treats women's matches
for variety. Like... Go ahead. Continue.
No, I was just going to say, WCW treats women's matches like WWE treats midget matches. It's just something to put on sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, like, I get going for variety, but it's just like, if you're, again, this is the Clash of the Champions. This is the equivalent of a pay-per-view for the time. You can't be doing stuff cold here. Like, can't you at least put these women on TV for a couple weeks prior to kind of establish who they are and what their issue is?
Yeah. I mean, it's a perfectly valid question. Neither one of these women is going to be in the company for all that much longer either, so.
No, they just kind of dropped this. Like women's wrestling always kind of just got dropped by WCW.
And this was a really bad time for it, because Jim Ross is right. Basically, the only thing going on in women's wrestling around this time is GLOW, and that's not a great time for women's wrestling.
So next up, we've got for the United States Tag Team Championship, the Steiner Brothers defending against Maximum Overdrive, who were not listed on that top 10 ranking they did earlier, but here they are nonetheless getting a shot at the U.S. tag titles.
Makes no sense.
Two jobbers. Like, yeah, just two guys, the Steiners beat the crap out of them. It's a good, fun Steiners match.
This is a Clash of Champions Tag Team Championship match. It's the third match before the end of the show. In the promo before this, the Steiner brothers are cutting a promo about Doom, who because they want the real tag team championships. Yeah. And I think Tony Schiavone at some point is just like, what do you think about Maximum Overdrive? And Rick Steiner's just like, we don't care about Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, this is one of those where scripting promos would have helped because they would have had a scripted line about, I don't know, how impressive they were.
Yep. Nope, not at all. And even better is then Rick Steiner's like, I go into every match with no plan at all. Cool.
All right, next up, we've got Stan Hansen against the Z-Man, Tom Zank.
And oh, legendary.
Goddamn, is Tom Zank one handsome man?
He is so handsome. Holy shit. His teeth are like shining. His hair's got the sheen. I wish
they brought Schiavone out for guest commentary on this one.
Oh, my God. Tom Zank. What a legendary figure in wrestling history. And I actually have a Tom Zank.
It just seems like he was kind of around for a lot of big moments, but didn't participate in any of them.
He really was. And he's one of the few guys on this show, like of all the guys who just get squashed, he obviously has the most potential of all of them. He can work a little. He has a great look. He's got like some level of charisma. It's kind of amazing that during this whole period, they never really go anywhere with him. He's always just kind of there.
What's the biggest push? The biggest push he ever got was probably Can-Am Connection in the WWF. They were on WrestleMania 3.
Yeah, maybe. I think he had a team with Pillman for a little while. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
But like, it was always teams. Like, he never got a singles push, really.
It's a grand mystery. Hansen just beats the fuck out of him, and I love it.
Beautiful. This is Stan Hansen, baby.
This is how you do a job match. You give the jobber nothing. Nothing.
And my favorite part too was Jim Ross was just like, well, Zank, don't let him get you out of the ring because that's where he does his damage. Hansen immediately throws him out of the ring and starts wailing on him. It's like, well.
Yeah, unfortunately, Stan Hansen, like, it's another, like, either WCW lowballed him on money or, like, Japan just offered him so much more that this run doesn't last very long. He's around for about 6 months and he goes back to Japan.
Well, the American wrestling industry could never really wrap its head around the idea that Stan Hansen was not an American wrestler. He was a wrestler from America, but he was a Japanese wrestler primarily. That's where all of his favorite contacts were. His wife was from Japan. His home was in Japan. He was a Japanese wrestler who just did tours of America. Yeah. But people kept trying to like lure him in and give him world title belts and stuff. And it was just stupid. Like, he was never going to be that guy for you. At best, he was going to be what Muda was for them.
Yeah. It's another of those. There's just some guys who just, for whatever reason, are they're American, but they just have their success in Japan, whether it was Stan Hansen or Terry Gordy in a singles context or Dr. Death, Scott Norton, Giant Bernard. I mean, I guess these guys all have the thing in common that they're big, giant, white American dudes.
Right. Japan's always going to have a place in its heart for those guys. But Stan Hansen is the reason it's always going to have a place in its heart for those guys.
How
Stan
has Ryback not gone to Japan yet?
They must not want him.
Seems like he's perfect for it.
Yeah, I mean, but they got a lot of guys like that there right now. But it's so funny because Stan Hansen is still there to this day and sort of in administrative capacity with New Japan. He's out there on all the big shows handing out the belt and being in the ring.
He's the ultimate legend in Japan.
He is. He is the American legend. Like, he is the bad man from Borneo.
During this match, Tony Schiavone, they actually do a split screen with Tony Schiavone, who's surely hiding his erection, interviewing Lex Luger, and Luger just fucking stumbles and stutters his way through this promo. Being asked about Ric Flair and the Black Scorpion, this did not come off well.
It almost made me feel like they didn't tell him ahead of time they were going to do this. Like, they were just backstage, and he was getting ready for his normal promo, and they were just like, hey, quick, cut back to Luger and ask him what he thinks about the Scorpion. And Luger's like, huh? What? Who?
Yeah. And then after the match is over, they go back and interview him again.
Just super weird. I don't know if they were trying to cut away from the match for a reason, but yeah, it just didn't come off well for anybody involved.
Yeah, I got nothing. So next up, we've got our sub-main event. It's Lex Luger defending the United States title against Ric Flair. These two guys had a lot of really great matches over the years. They'd fought for the NWA title on a number of occasions. This time, Flair's in the unusual position of being the challenger. Basically, the storyline is Flair is obsessed with getting to Sting, getting the world title back. So his plan is to win the U.S. title, and then he'll be the number one contender to the world title.
Right.
And he really plays up the, like, Flair's gone crazy, he's maniacal, he's obsessed with being champion. I really thought he played that role well in this match, and it was really different from the normal Ric Flair.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. And it was a good spin, because they had kind of done Luger Flair to death a little bit to this point. And
they had a lot of matches.
Is it the following year that they do Luger heel?
Luger turns heel when he wins. Luger was going to beat Flair for the belt, and then Flair quit and took the belt with him. But Luger turns heel when he wins the match against Barry Windham to name the new champion.
Right. But they're going to kind of retire Flair Luger for a little bit after this, just because they've had such a run already to this
point. Flair's gone. They don't really... It feels like they don't touch again for a really long time after this, because Flair goes to the WWF, and then kind of when he's coming back to WCW, Luger's in the WWF, and then in kind of the Monday Night Wars era, they don't really get after each other much either.
No, they're kind of on the same team the whole time. So, I mean, it's kind of the end of like a very historic run.
Until they teamed up as Team Package.
God damn it. Yeah. Team Package.
I would say, I don't remember if that was actually Russo. That may have just been before Russo came in when they were doing WWF knockoff stuff.
Oh my goodness.
But I mean, these guys really have great chemistry, because it's just like Flair takes such a good ass whooping and Luger's really good at just throwing people around and posing. So you just get Luger like clothesline, clothesline, press slam, Flair begs off, crowd goes crazy.
I mean, Luger was kind of the perfect foil for Flair, because Luger couldn't bring any of the personality, but Flair could bring all of it. Yeah. And then Luger could just kind of be like the exact, like almost like a robot that Flair could program to do what he wants in order to have the ideal Flair match.
Yeah. And so Flair eventually takes over, and he's working body parts. He's more vicious than usual. I think he's working extra hard here, because Jim Herd was trying to cut his pay, was suggesting he was washed up, he needed to change his look, needed to change his gimmick. So I think he's trying to show that he's still got some gas left.
I'll always want to know why exactly Jim Herd thought he was such an authority on all of this stuff.
Well, he was a man who had a lot of success in business. And you ever meet rich guys who like try to give advice outside of the, like, Jim Herd surely knew how to run a pizza restaurant, and like people say that derisively, but like he was really successful running Pizza Hut.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking about he took Pizza Hut from like a regional chain to like global, like huge.
But it doesn't mean he knows how to do things outside of that realm. But when you've had that much success in life, you kind of just become convinced you know everything, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah,
and he was put in charge of this by Ted Turner. Like, yeah, they thought he was the guy. And, I mean, obviously they were totally wrong, but he took their vote of confidence too far.
Oh, boy. And he did a lot of damage before they finally got rid of him and replaced him with somebody just as bad.
Yeah. Luger makes his comeback. He hits a huge superplex, really close two count. Flair gets his foot on the ropes. Stan Hansen interferes for a DQ after 12 minutes. He attacks Luger. That sets up Luger and Hansen for the U.S. title. And if I'm remembering right, I think Hansen wins the title at Halloween Havoc.
Nice.
Yeah.
The only thing I would have liked to see added to this is for like Flair to kind of go crazy on Hansen, because like he cost him his shot at the world title. Yeah. Like Flair could have gotten it, but yeah.
Yeah, Flair kind of ends up being an afterthought in this.
You know what? You could even fix the Black Scorpion storyline by have it not start until this fails.
Right? Yeah.
You could still have it be Flair and then just have it not begin until Flair couldn't get it by any other means.
And then it would make sense.
That is part of the weirdness of this. It's like Flair's so desperate. It's like, yeah, Flair, it's not like it's been like Flair just lost the title in June at the Bash. Like, he hasn't really even gotten his rematch yet. There's no reason he should be quite so desperate to get the title back yet.
He's already like a 12-time world champion by this point, right? He's lost it 11 other times.
Yeah. So it's main event time. Tony Schiavone introduces a pre-recorded interview with the Black Scorpion.
It's the Shockmaster.
Yeah, it's the Ole Anderson voice. It's a sinister sounding voice, but it's very really cartoony. The setup is kind of cool. Like, it's really dark in the studio. You can't see who it is. It's the sinister voice. Like, some of the dialogue is kind of silly. Like, I was watching these old promos on YouTube, and one of them he starts is like, "Stan, how was your week?" Yeah, he mentions again the key date. It's California, Los Angeles, 1986.
It's like, why are you pigeonholing yourself with this? Why?
Later he would add in, or maybe it's Tulsa. Maybe that's who.
Maybe it's Tulsa.
Could be.
Tulsa, Venice Beach, it's all the same, you know.
Black Scorpion comes out. He's got a black mask, black tights on. Big jack dude. It's Al Perez under the mask here. It would be different people kind of every time. I don't know who played like the real quote unquote physical Black Scorpion here. I don't know if it was Ole Anderson.
But I think it was Ole Anderson. So I read it a little bit into it, and it seemed to be that at least somewhat the backup plan was for Ole Anderson to just be the guy under the mask at some point.
That would have been kind of interesting, actually. I mean, he'd been gone for a while, but yeah, Ole is like the puppet master. I think he probably could have pulled that off, kind of like a Kevin Sullivan Dungeon of Doom type of thing.
Right, but then it just turned out he couldn't physically do it. And then it was going to be the Angel of Death, who Sting had wrestled on the indies a bunch, but nobody knew who the fuck he was, and he couldn't work.
No, I don't even know who that is.
Yeah, I saw his name, but I only remember the Angel of Death.
Yeah. They have a match. It's an okay match. You know, Black Scorpion, big and impressive looking, a little stiff, but I don't know. Al Perez was a decent wrestler. Apparently the rap on him was he just like thought he should be the world champion, thought he should be the top guy, and like couldn't accept that he wasn't being pushed as the top star.
Did he see his own match?
No, apparently not.
This fucking sucked.
Sting keeps trying to take the mask off. Scorpion slams Sting on the ramp, but Sting just kind of stands up and no-sells it. Really long heat segment from the Scorpion. Not much of interest in happening. Sting makes a comeback. He hits the flying body press. He hits a clothesline. The Stinger splash. Retains the title in 8 minutes. All right. He goes, rips off the Scorpion's mask, and he has another mask.
Another mask!
Oh, boy. And now the real Black Scorpion comes out, out on the ramp. This distracts Sting. The minion escapes. So Sting didn't beat the real Scorpion. Your princess is in another castle. The feud continues.
I want to kind of give Sting credit here, too. The reason Sting would continue for like the next 7 years to be successful, despite the fact that everything else in WCW was like a terrible disaster all around him, is that he was bulletproof because even in a match like this, which objectively sucks and he's wrestling someone who sucks and it's a bad storyline, it's all bad, but he's just a delight.
Yeah,
he's got so much energy and enthusiasm. When he's going for the mask, he's like diving all over Perez, trying to get it off of him. Like, he's so likable. Like, he's genuinely likable.
And I think part of being that earnest babyface is being kind of dumb and naive, as Sting was consistently portrayed as. Like, he's such a good guy. He can't see the obvious traps being laid for him.
Sting is the dumb babyface. He is who that is. He is the trope walking among us.
So we come back from a commercial. We get an interview with Sting, who is then attacked by Sid, and that sets up the main event for Halloween Havoc, Sting defending against Sid Vicious. So at that show, Sting retained the title in one of the all-time WCW clusterfucks. let me try to explain this. They're having their match. They fight backstage. Sting and Sid come back. The camera doesn't follow them through the curtain. They're back there for like a minute. And then, like, they come back through the curtain. They go to the ring. And, like, Sid immediately pins Sting. And at this point, you notice, wait, Sting is like 6 inches too tall. What's going on here? Because it's actually Barry Windham dressed as Sting. And then the real Sting comes out. And, like, he has, like, rope around his wrist. And, like, this is somehow supposed to tell us that this is the real Sting. But the referee immediately restarts the match and Sting gets the pin. There's a creative idea. There's a good idea somewhere in there, but they don't pull it off, right?
This is one of those stupid things in wrestling history. It really is. Like, this is the kind of thing that The Miz should do to try to win a world title. Why the fuck are you putting this into a Sting versus Sid Vicious match? Why does Sid Vicious need the help? He's Sid.
Sid should have just powerbombed Sting right through the ring and pinned him and won the title because he's Sid.
He's Sid. He rules the world. Literally, he rules it. It's his.
So Sting then went on to face the Black Scorpion in a steel cage match at Starrcade. He won the match, and the Black Scorpion was revealed to be Ric Flair. And this was all just a ruse to fuck with Sting and get a world title shot that he could have gotten anyway. And his master plan failed. But then a couple weeks later, he won the title back at a house show. So, I don't know. But by then, like, Ole had been fired by then, and Dusty Rhodes had taken over the book. So they just kind of, the old stuff didn't really matter at that point. They were starting fresh.
I would have loved it if they had pulled off the mask to reveal it was like Dusty or somebody. Somebody who comically could not have had this build.
Well, that was part of it. Is like, I think when Flair was wrestling with Scorpion in that match, I think he wore a shirt to try to make it less obvious that it was Ric Flair, even though like everyone in the crowd, as soon as he walked out, knew it was him.
Yep.
And he also cut his hair so that you couldn't see his hair coming out of the back of the mask.
Should have just like made it Ron Simmons or something like that. Like, wait a minute.
There's something different about this Scorpion.
It's the Black Scorpion. Duh. Yeah.
Why can't there be a Black Scorpion?
You know what? I'm going to say it right now. If Ron Simmons had gotten a title run as the Black Scorpion, that would have been fucking amazing.
No, instead he got a title run as Ron Simmons, and it sucked.
That sucks. The Black Scorpion, man. That's like a superhero.
Oh, so Flair agreed to take the hit because Barry Windham was the other choice. And, well, one, it would have been ridiculous for it to be Barry Windham because, again, Barry Windham is like 6'8".
Why did they keep picking Barry Windham for this stuff? They got a whole roster of no-name lookalikes in the back, and they always pick Barry.
I think it was just one of these, like, Barry Windham never seemed like he gave that much of a shit. Like, he just wanted to drink beer and get his paycheck so he would do whatever they asked him to do.
I just love the idea that on this show, I mean, Barry Windham wasn't on this show, but you know what I mean. Like, Barry Windham's just sitting in the back with nothing to do. Meanwhile, Mike Rotunda, who you could have put under a mask with no difference to his personality, is just out there being Mike Rotunda.
Oof. So the story is WCW continued to flounder. Heard finally got shit canned in like 1992. They replaced him with Bill Watts. That also didn't work. And then they brought in Eric Bischoff, who eventually turned this thing into, you know, one of the most successful wrestling company in history up to that point. So that we'll cover more of that story in future podcasts, I'm sure. But I always try to give Bischoff as much credit as possible. They were absolutely falling apart, and he really did turn them into a championship organization.
Oh yeah, Eric Bischoff is why people believe to this day that if TNA just gets the right person in charge, it can all turn around. Yeah. It's not true, but it did happen one time in wrestling history, so people believe that it can.
but it'll never be like that again. It was the right guy with the right amount of money and influence in the right industry at the right time.
Yeah. So I think that pretty much does it for Clash of the Champions Fall Brawl. Absolutely abysmal. Don't watch this show.
No.
Like, nothing.
You can't even watch it on the network. It's not even on there.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, wait. How did you find it?
It's under Clash of the Champions. They've got all of them.
Oh, damn it. I looked under Fall Brawl. Never mind. I had to watch this shit on YouTube all blurry.
Damn it. This Mountain Madness Fall Brawl. It's a different thing. Oh, yeah. So next week, we're going with something radically different. We will jump forward to 1997 for one of the key moments of the Attitude Era as we review the... Oh, I'm choking on the date. I think it's September 22nd, 1997 episode of Raw, but it's the famous one from Madison Square Garden where Steve Austin stuns Vince McMahon for the first time. We have the infamous Triple H Cactus Jack street fight, the first one, and all sorts of other fun Attitude Era shenanigans.
And despite my credibility as a reviewer of wrestling, once again, we have selected a show that I have never seen.
We swear Cuse has actually watched wrestling.
I've watched a couple matches in my day.
Ooh, but yeah, all that to look forward to next week. That wraps us for Clash of the Champions, Fall Brawl, Mount Madness. Don't ever watch this show, kids. Just go watch this Raw instead. It's much better.
Much better.